Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Dr. Rupert Sheldrake. He's a biologist and the author of more than 90 technical papers and 14 books, including Science Set Free. After studying at Cambridge and Harvard Universities, he worked in Hyderabad, India, as principal plant physiologist at the International Crops Research Institute for the semi-arid tropics, and lived for 2 years in the Benedictine ashram of Father Bede Griffiths. From 2005 to 2010, he was director of the Parrott-Warwick Project for the Study of Unexplained Human and Animal Abilities, funded by Trinity College, Cambridge. He's currently a fellow of the Institute of Noetic Sciences in Petaluma, California, and of Schumacher College in Darlington, Devon, UK. He lives in London with his wife, Jill Peirce, with whom he has two sons. His new book is Ways to Go Beyond and Why They Work. His website is sheldrake.org. So first off, thank you for your incredible work over the decades. And second, thank you for being on the program. In your new book, you talk about the... you say early on, I believe that it's only through spiritual practices and direct experiences that we can effectively deepen our own connections with the more than human realms of consciousness and become more aware of the underlying source of all consciousness and all nature. And so before we talk about ways to go beyond, can you talk about going beyond and what you mean by that?
Yes, I think spiritual experiences and mystical experiences are of a greater connection. They give a sense that we're part of something much bigger than ourselves. Obviously, we're part of something bigger than ourselves. We're part of the universe. But they give us the impression that we're part of something conscious that's bigger than ourselves. The materialist point of view, which still dominates science, says there is no consciousness greater than our own, or at least if there is, it's in little green men on other planets. But basically, the whole universe is inanimate, purposeless, and unconscious. But that's not the feeling you get when you have a spontaneous mystical experience or when you do spiritual practices. They reveal that there are realms of consciousness beyond our own. And the point of spiritual practices is to make it more likely that we come into contact with those realms of consciousness. So that's why this book is about seven different spiritual practices, all of which are ways of establishing a greater sense of connectedness.
So why is this important?
Well, it's important for a variety of reasons. First of all, there's a lot of scientific research now that shows that people who have religious or spiritual practices are happier, healthier, and live longer. That's pretty important on an individual level. It's important on a societal level because if it's true that these practices make you happier and healthier, then not having them presumably makes you unhappier and unhealthier. And that means, and what happens, I think, for a lot of people who completely bought into the materialist secular worldview is that they find it depressing. And I think that's why depression is an endemic feature of modern industrial secular societies with huge numbers of people on antidepressant pills. So that's one reason. Another reason is that if we feel connected with a greater reality than our own personal desires, our own greeds, and our own desires to consume and so on are less important. We're less self-centered. And thirdly, if we recognize that the whole universe is alive, that the Earth is alive, that we're part of a living system, we recognize that the arrogant attitude that it's all there just for us to exploit and make a profit from is totally inappropriate. It's obviously destructive. But this makes it clearer why it's destructive and gives us a stronger motive for doing something about it.
So as I was reading... as I was reading your new book, Ways to Go Beyond and Why They Work, I kept thinking of a couple things. One of them was that so many indigenous people have said to me that the fundamental difference between sort of the Western perspective and indigenous perspectives is that most Westerners perceive the world as consisting of resources to exploit as opposed to other beings to enter into relationship with. And so I kept thinking of this book as a powerful means to use the word that a lot of Indigenous people use, to decolonize, to help break down that perception of the world as consisting of resources to be exploited. So I'll leave that there, and then I'll bring up the other thing in a second.
Yes. Well, I think that the Indigenous people, generally speaking, have a view of a relationship with animals, plants, with the world around them. And I think one of the things that we need to do is learn from them, because we've had the assumption they're all just stupid, childish, and primitive. They need to be educated. And so we've sent out missionaries of modern education to every country in the world, so they all learn about the scientific worldview, which basically says that nature's dead and it is resources to be exploited. Destroying these cultures, which in many ways have a lot we can learn from about relating to nature in a healthier way.
And the other thing that I was thinking as I read through this is I was thinking about the work of Felicitas Goodman, who has written about how she believes that modern humans are what she called ecstasy deprived, and that there were like a lot of the cave paintings of humans were not just random figures, but instead those were instructions on how to help people enter trance states. And so I kept thinking about, as I'm reading through this book and the relationship of sports or fasting with the ways to go beyond, I kept also thinking about what she said about us being ecstasy deprived and about the effects that that has on our psyches and on our behavior, and how it leads to a lot of self-destructive behavior.
Yes, well, I think it does. And I think the point about ecstasy, which comes about very often through spiritual practices, is that it gives this sense of connection. It gives a sense of connection which is usually associated with happiness. If you feel happy, then you're much less likely to feel you've got to buy things, get things, consume things, conquer things, etc. For people to, I think our society is actually based on people feeling unhappy and discontented, because only if you feel unhappy and discontented do you go on working so hard as a kind of workaholic without having days off. And indeed, that's one of the points in my book, the creation of holidays and festivals is part of every traditional society. We've now turned it to 24/7 commerce, so that people can be making things, buying things, working all the time, instead of just hanging out, having fun, not feeling the need to do lots of things, because they can be in a state of happiness and in parts of the time ecstasy, which gives this sense of connection, which is in itself satisfying.
So would you rather, at this point of the interview, dive into some of the practices of this book, like sports, or would you rather do a brief overview of your book, Science and Spiritual Practices, and talk a little bit about meditation, flow of gratitude? So do you want to go there first, or do you want to just dive straight into this book?
I think I'd rather dive straight into this book, actually, because my other book, my Science and Spiritual Practices, is like a prequel to this book, with seven different spiritual practices. But in this one, it's the one freshest in my mind and most recently published, and the one about which people probably know least about. So I think probably better to start with this one.
Okay. So so should we start with the relationship between spirituality and sports, which I just absolutely love?
Yes, why not? The reason I put that first in this book, the chapter on sports, the spiritual side of sports, is because I think that in the modern world, sports are the main way in which people enter altered states of consciousness. It's not normally thought of as a spiritual practice. I mean, in the ancient world, in ancient Greece, sports were sacred to the gods. The Olympic Games were a religious festival, not just a sports spectacular. And in the East, the martial arts and books like Zen and the Art of Archery remind us that they're seen as part of a flow, as part of a spiritual process, not just about winning and not just about brute strength and so on. I think the point about sports is that they're important because they involve the practice of physical skill. There are lots of sports which are not games, mountain climbing, for example, or skydiving or something like that. There are games that are not sports, like chess. But the point about sports is they involve being intensely involved in physical skills. And when you're involved in a physical skill, it shuts down the default mode network, those regions of the brain linked together, which underlie rumination, worries, anxieties, and so forth. In meditation, the default mode network becomes less active. That's one of the points of meditation, to reduce the activity of the default mode network. But in sports, it's almost instantaneous. A friend of mine who was a very busy business person and also a mountaineer told me that at the busiest time of his life, he just couldn't stop thinking. He couldn't sleep. His mind was so active. And meditation didn't work for him. But by the time he was 50 feet up a rock face, he said he was totally in the present. And I had a conversation a few weeks ago in London with the world champion free solo highline person. He walks on these sort of high lines like tightropes over 1,000-foot drops with no safety harness. He does this over waterfalls in British Columbia between skyscrapers and cities. And I asked him why he did it. And he said that when he was doing this, he was so intensely in the present because the danger was so great. One slip and he's literally dead. That he had to be completely concentrated in this game. Put him into a state of ecstasy, a kind of state of complete blissful absorption and outside all his normal concerns and worries. He said it was almost addictive, so joyful and spiritual was this experience, which is why he keeps doing it. Of course, it could prove to be a fatal habit in the long run. I think that's also why a lot of people like the thrill of speed, skiing downhill at 60 miles an hour. If you're not totally in the present, then you're dead. So I think that the sports connect us with the present time, and they give a sense of being in the flow. And when they're team sports, they also make us connected to other people. Even watching team sports, like watching a football game, connects us with others, which is why I think so many people like watching sports events. These are all about connection and going beyond our own limited selves.
When I was in college, I was a high jumper, and then later I was a high jump coach. And something I've said to non-high jumpers, and I also said to my high jumpers themselves, was that when you get up to jump, you can't think that you're going to make the jump, because if you're thinking at all, you're not going to make it. So you just have to get up and then get out of the mind. And then a line I wrote in my 20s about high jumping was that as you approach the bar, you have to run just fast enough. If you run too slow, then you don't get enough height. And if you run too fast, you lose control on the corner. So what you have to do is you have to approach the ragged edge of control where instinct and euphoria set you free from time and consciousness. And that seems to be sort of talking about what you're talking about.
Very much so. I think that's a really clear description, Derek. I think it puts it really well. And that thing about it just happening, you know, that's the point in Zen and the Art of Archery. You're not trying to hit the target. You're so skilled at it, you reach a point where it's as if the arrow almost does it by itself with no thought. And I think that's the state of mind that really makes sports a kind of spiritual practice. And it's why a lot of people do sports. They enter this altered state of consciousness, which is very different from what's going on in just ordinary everyday life.
So what is the relationship between you talking about this? Let's take advantage of the fact that as well as being a spiritual human being, that you are a scientist. And what's the relationship between what you're saying and science? Or, I mean, take this anywhere you want or nowhere if you don't want to.
Well, the reason I've written these two books is because there's now a lot of science, scientific studies of spiritual practices. So it's one way in which science and spirituality are actually coming together in a mutually constructive way. And we're used to the idea of a kind of conflict between science and spirituality or science and religion. But here we have something where they come together. And what I think one of the things that science illuminates here is the default mode network and the role it plays in our ruminations and anxieties and the way that sports shut that down. There are other aspects, of course, which I haven't talked about. In sports activities, we have changes in hormone levels, and those, of course, also affect our state of mind. And adrenaline is one, testosterone is another. And these hormonal changes are associated with sports. Positive psychologists have studied the state of being in flow, which is what makes people feel happy. And sports are one of the great ways of getting into the flow. So there are different aspects of science which bear on this. And in sports psychology and sports science, people make detailed studies of how these things influence bodies and minds. And some sports trainers now emphasize a kind of meditative approach to the sport, where it's not just building up muscles and doing a physical skill. It must involve some aspect of the mind and some control of the mind. And as you wrote so clearly about high jumping, it's not about thinking, and indeed thinking would interfere with the entire process. And I think that the scientific studies of sports have illuminated all these things in a way that wouldn't have been so obvious before.
A couple things. One of them is I remember, and you know, I'm almost 60 years old, so high jumping was a long time ago, but I remember my coach turning me on to this study. This is back in the 80s, about how some people had studied, some sports psychologists had studied skiers who did practice runs the day before their real event, and those who knew the course, but then would go through basically a guided meditation where they calmed themselves down and then they went through the course. And the similarities between those two experiences of meditating on doing the run and doing the run were pretty striking. That always struck me. So I incorporated that into my own high jumping, where the day before a meet, I would lie down in front of the high jump area and then go through every single jump that I was going to do the next day. And I wouldn't be thinking, oh, I'm going to do this, I'm going to do this. I would just be watching myself do it.
Yes, that's very interesting. Is that what some people at that time called the inner game? There were all those books on the inner game of tennis and that sort of thing.
I think so.
Yes, yes. There was a fashion for books on the inner game of this and that, and it was to do with that kind of process where you go through it mentally, you go through it in your mind, in your imagination, as it were, rather than just doing it physically. And this helps the process.
So a nice segue to the next chapter of the book, which is learning from animals, I really enjoy sports. I enjoy watching sports, doing sports as far as I can. And it has become clear to me that most sports are basically a variant on keep away. And of course, non-humans do keep away. And humans are not the only creatures who who play. So can you first talk a little bit about play in animals and then talk about what else we can learn from animals about ecstatic states or about ways to go beyond?
I think play usually involves an absorption into the activity. And again, it involves getting to a state of flow where you're not just ruminating, thinking, or worrying. And clearly, young animals, when they're playing, are completely absorbed in it, as are children. And that's when they're really happy. If children are playing well and having fun, it makes them really happy because of that absorption of being in the flow, as in sports. I think that the other ways we learn from animals are partly because animals are, generally speaking, much more in the present than we are. They don't have default mode networks going through worrying thoughts, all in language. Most of our thinking is in language, which they don't have. So a cat, if it's sitting purring on your lap, is completely in the present. It's perfectly happy to be there. It's be here now principle. And its purring is an expression of that happiness. And if we just tune into it and let the cat bring us into the present rather than stroke it distractedly while watching television, there's a way in which it can bring us into the present. And when someone's with a dog that clearly wants them to throw a stick or a ball and it completely wants to play, it absorbs people into, they enter that dog world of absorption in play. And again, thoughts and worries melt away. So I think animals bring us into the present, bring us into the state of flow. I think that's one of the main reasons why people keep them. As societies get richer and more urbanized, they have less need for functional animals. If you live on a small peasant farm, you need cows and goats, sheep and cats to catch mice, and dogs to act as sheep dogs and so on, or guard dogs. If you live in a 20th floor apartment in a modern city, you don't need animals. In fact, they're expensive, they're inconvenient, you've got big vet bills. If you take your dog for a walk, you have to pick up the poo. These are all serious disadvantages. But despite all those, people keep these animals. And why? I think it's not just the companionship. I think it's the fact that they bring us into the present and take us away from our very human worries and concerns. So, and I think that animals also have a direct connection to the more than animal world. I don't think that the spiritual realm is beamed only into humans. I think the whole of nature is within a spiritual reality, and that animals have their own access to it. A dolphin playing in the bow wave of a boat, enjoying its play and being in the present. A lizard basking in the sun, maybe in a state of samadhi, maybe like in a state of meditative bliss. Birds singing songs beautifully, I think, are absolutely. So I think all these things about animals do have a spiritual dimension, and they bring a spiritual dimension into our lives too.
And I think that I have several friends who would completely disown me if I were to speak to you and not mention your book, Dogs That Know When Their Owners Are Coming Home, because that is one of your pieces of work that has most profoundly influenced so many people I know. Can you talk a little bit about that and then relate that to the current subject?
Yes, well, that is one of the aspects that I discuss. And what I do in the Dogs That Know When Their Owners Are Coming Home is discuss the unexplained abilities of animals, which I spent years investigating and still do. And the three main categories are first telepathy, secondly, premonitions. Many animals have premonitions. And thirdly, the sense of direction, the astonishing way that homing pigeons can get home from an unfamiliar place 600 miles away the same day, or that migrating animals like the Arctic tern can fly to literally the other side of the world, the Antarctic, and find its way back to the same place the next year. How do they do it? How do they know where to go? So there's a whole chapter on the sense of direction. Premonitions deal with earthquakes and tsunamis and premonitions of epileptic seizures. There's many examples of where animals seem to know what's going to happen in a mysterious way. It's none of these things have an easy explanation in terms of standard physical clues. If standard physical clues were that easy to detect, then seismologists should be predicting earthquakes, but actually dogs do a better job. And lots of other animals, including wild animals. But the main experimental investigations in the book are about animal telepathy. And many animals pick up human thoughts and intentions. They pick up each other's thoughts and intentions too, but we notice it more when they're picking up ours. I've got a database with more than 6,000 case histories of unexplained behavior by animals. And one of the common forms of behavior is the eponymous theme of my book, Dogs That Know When Their Owners Are Coming Home. The fact that many dogs know when their owners are coming home, they go and wait at a door or a window, often 10 minutes before the person comes home, sometimes half an hour or more. No one thinks it's odd if it's just a minute or two. It could be footsteps in the street, the crunch of car wheels on the gravel, that sort of thing. But with these longer anticipations, the obvious explanation that most people come up with before they've thought about it is, oh, well, it must be routine, or they just hear a familiar car engine. In my experiments on this, of which I've done hundreds, I and my assistant film the place the dog waits the whole time the person is out. We have them go at least 5 miles away, and we have them come home at randomly selected times. They don't know in advance. We tell them by cell phone when to come home. No one at home knows when they're coming, and they travel in unfamiliar vehicles, so there's no familiar car sounds or smells. And in those conditions, the dogs still know when they're coming home and go and wait, and we've got all the filmed footage to show it. This is all published in peer-reviewed papers in scientific journals, but it's summarized in my book, Dogs That Know When Their Owners Are Coming Home. Similar studies, things happen with cats, sometimes with parrots, sometimes with horses. It's not just dogs. And there are many other ways in which dogs pick up people's intentions. Now, I think what we can learn from this is that psychic abilities like telepathy, premonitions, presentiments, and also the sense of direction are not special things that humans have. They don't make us special. They're not sort of spiritual aspects of the higher mind of humans. On the contrary, they're part of our animal nature, and many animals do them much better than we do. They're much more sensitive than we are. And humans have them as a result of an evolutionary process that's endowed animals with these abilities. We inherit them from our animal ancestors. One thing that tells us is that we are interconnected with others and other people. We are interconnected. Another thing it tells us is that psychic abilities, the telepathy, premonitions, and so on, are not the same as spiritual connections. They're part of the world of communication, as it were, a horizontal world where we're linking to other animals, other people, and to the environment. They're not about what you could think of as a kind of vertical or spiritual dimension. They're no more spiritual or no less spiritual than the sense of smell or the sense of sight. They're a kind of sixth or seventh sense that's just part of the way we live in the world and the way animals live in the world. So I think these animals can help us recognize our own psychic nature and also help us to distinguish between that and spiritual phenomena.
You know, a story along those lines, my mother died 14 months ago. And before that, she and I lived on the same property for 20 years. And She had a magnificent relationship with bears, and I see bears still every day. But she had a really special relationship, especially with this one bear that she called Mama. It was the first bear she really had a relationship with. And the bear would come every year and show her babies off. And then maybe 6 or 7 years ago, Mama stopped showing up. We didn't know if she was dead. We didn't know if she'd, you know, moved to a different territory, whatever. And then as my mom was dying of cancer, about 2 weeks before she died, we looked outside one day and there was Mama sitting outside the porch. And my mom said, well, I don't know if she's coming to tell me I'm going to get better or if she's coming to tell me goodbye. And I said, well, I think she's coming to tell you it's going to be okay. And the point is that we hadn't seen the bear for 8 years. And then suddenly she shows up, or 6 or 7 years, however long. And then suddenly she shows up 2 weeks before my mom dies. It's just another example of what you were talking about.
That's very interesting, Derek. Very moving, too. I mean, the bear clearly formed a bond with her. And I would have, I guess, picked up that she was ill. A lot of dogs and cats know when their owners are ill, even when they're far away. And I think it's, well, I mean, human people do too. A lot of mothers know when their child is in danger or has had an accident or has died. This ability to pick up the need of others when they're sick is indeed part of what happens in animal societies and human societies. And I would say that probably insofar as the bear's normal instincts are directed towards other bears, not people. In the bear world, picking up that someone you're attached to, that a bear you're attached to is sick, you'd go there because you want to help them. And obviously the bear couldn't do much to help your mother as she was dying of cancer. But in a way, just showing up must have helped her. It must have given her a great sense of connection and being cared about by an animal she cared about.
It did. Let's move to the next. Thank you for that. And also, I just want to say before we go on that I wish every scientist was more like you. And I have some real problems with the sort of straight materialist scientific perspective, which I think is incredibly powerful and also incredibly dangerous and is very good for some things and has in some ways blinded us to some other things. So I that's one of the things I just really appreciate about your work is it combines this I don't have a lot of patience for just sort of straight woo-woo stuff. And I also don't have a lot of patience for a straight mechanistic perspective. And I love how you are able to walk back and forth to bring sort of the rigor of science to these almost necessarily more amorphous topics. And I just think that that's brilliant. And sorry to go on and on about how great you are, but your work has been so important to me and so many others.
Thanks for saying so, Derek. It is true. I mean, like you, I'm appalled by the materialistic narrowness of many scientists. And I'm also not very keen on completely off-the-wall sort of fantastical ideas. And I'm constantly reminded of them because I get an awful lot of emails from people, and some of them are from people who are plainly quite crazy or have completely unrealistic ideas. You're right, that's exactly what I'm trying to do. I'm trying to extend a scientific approach and scientific understanding into areas where it's been very little applied so far. It's partly because exploring these unexplored areas is much more fun and much more interesting scientifically. It's also something I actually enjoy doing. I mean, for example, investigating dogs that know when their owners are coming home. Here's something which millions of dog owners say happens, and most of them are perfectly normal, reasonable people. They're not crazy. They're not stupid. They say it's happening. Well, why not find out? Most of my colleagues are only too keen to just to try and explain it away or brush it aside. But it's only by investigating it we can actually learn something new. And I think there's a huge amount new to learn that's not there on the mechanistic scientific map. And almost anything to do with mind or consciousness is not on that map, because the belief there is that the mind is nothing but the brain. And it's also a belief that consciousness is confined to brains, human brains above all, animal brains to a lesser degree, and then the rest of the nature not at all. Whereas if consciousness exists beyond the human level, underlying the universe, and also in maybe planets and stars, and as many forms consciousness may take, then it's simply sane. It's rational and sane to try and come to terms with the world in which we're living, rather than have a worldview that closes all these things out. So I actually think this is where science, sooner or later, has to go. And it's very exciting, actually, exploring areas which are still relatively unexplored. There's not much of the surface of the Earth that's still unexplored, but there's huge realms of reality that are unexplored scientifically.
So I have made a terrible mistake in this interview, which is that what you're saying is so interesting, and I've wanted to focus on so many details that we only have about 10 minutes left, and we still have several of these ways to go. So can you move? We have about 10 to 12 minutes left. So can you go through the other ways and in about, say, 8 minutes, and then we can have a 2-minute wind down?
Okay, I'll do a very brief summary. There's a chapter on fasting, part of all religious traditions, and also something you can just do for health reasons. And what I do there is talk about the physiology of fasting, changes in blood levels. The fact it's psychoactive is because when you're breaking down fats, when you're fasting, you make so-called ketone bodies, acetone, beta hydroxybutyric acid, and acetoacetic acid. Beta hydroxybutyric acid, BHB, is very closely related to gamma hydroxybutyric acid, GHB, and GABA, gamma aminobutyric acid, both of which are neurotransmitters. And the levels of those change in the brain as a result of fasting and ketosis in the blood. Fasting is psychoactive, and it can lead to a greater clarity of mind and more vivid dreams. And it's also very healthy. And so I discussed that, the background, the physiology, how to do it. All my chapters end with a short how-to section. I then move on to psychedelics. It's a chapter called Spiritual Openings Through Cannabis and Psychedelics, because I think in the modern world, many people have a kind of spiritual opening through taking these drugs. For some people, they can be disastrous, so in inducing psychosis. I'm not saying everyone ought to be taking psychedelics, but I am saying that for some people, including me, taking them has had a mind-opening effect, which has given a sense of a far greater conscious reality than I had before. Since I was educated in a very scientifically mechanistic, materialist worldview, when I first took LSD around 1971, this probably more than anything opened my mind to other realms of consciousness, and led me to an interest in meditation and yoga, things that I would certainly never have thought of doing before. I talk about prayer, petitionary prayer, and how it differs from meditation. Prayer has very beneficial effects on the health of those who pray. But it's doing a very different thing from meditation, where you're withdrawing from your concerns with the world and withdrawing from thoughts. in prayer, you start with an invocation to a higher form of consciousness, God, a saint, an angel, or God, the Father, the Son, or the Holy Spirit. You invoke one aspect, a higher being, at the beginning of the prayer, Our Father, who art in heaven, for example, or Hail Mary, full of grace, or Om Namah Shivaya. You start with an invocation and connect that spiritual realm with your concerns in the world. People are sick, worries about the climate, worries about the way things are going in human affairs, worries about concerns about people you know, about your own health, about prayers for protection. All these are very, very practical things, and they link the spiritual realm to our everyday life. And in that sense, prayer is like the opposite of meditation. It's breathing out compared with breathing in. And then I discuss holy days and festivals. All civilizations, all religions have holy days, and holy days are holidays. It's the same word. You can't have a holy day unless it's a holiday, because a holy day is when you come together to celebrate with other people. The weekly holy day of the Sabbath in the Jewish tradition and Sunday in the Christian tradition is about not working, so you have time to praise God, spend time with your family, walk in the countryside, make love, listen to music, hang out, dance. They're celebrations, and we need that collective celebration as part of our, just part of our human nature. Traditional societies have their ecstatic dances, their chanting and singing. Many modern people don't have any of this in their lives. And the 24/7 culture is trying to erode the importance of all the festivals. A holiday when people aren't working is seen as just another marketing opportunity when you can get them into shopping malls or doing more online shopping. So recovering a sense of holy days and festivals is extremely important. So that's a practice. And then I end with just being kind, which is the most fundamental of all, really.
I want to go back to the holy days for a second. I was raised a Seventh-day Adventist, and a lot of it was frankly kind of silly, but one of the things that I just loved about my upbringing was that we would follow the Jewish Sabbath. So from Friday night sundown to Saturday night sundown, there was no television, no shopping, and my particular family would go to church on Saturday morning, and then Saturday afternoon would almost always be spent in nature. And it was again, some of the religion was kind of silly, but that was one of the most important things of my childhood, was to make a day where, I didn't watch cartoons on Saturday morning. It was a day for being out in the real world. It was great.
Well, that's great. I think that's one of the great strengths of traditional religion, that having these periods. I mean, Jewish people do it, Seventh-day Adventists do it on Saturdays, many Christians do it on Sundays, but it's such an important part of our life to have that space in our lives. And I think a lot of people growing up today just don't have that at all.
Before we close, we still have 4 or 5 minutes. Before we close, can you talk a little bit about the science of being nice? I mean, how does that help to be nice? Apart from the obvious, being nice is just sort of a nice thing to do.
Well, I think that the being kind to others is rooted in our animal nature, and I discussed the evolutionary background of this in human societies. All social animals have to cooperate with each other, otherwise you wouldn't have a society. I mean, this is most obvious in the case of ants, bees, termites, and wasps, the social insects. Have millions of insects in some colonies, working together for the common good. If ants see injured ants of their own species, they'll go over and help them. Mutual help is just part of the way in which these societies work. So it's built into our nature that we should help other people. Parents have to help their children. If they didn't, the children wouldn't survive. And so it's very deep in our evolutionary nature. It's very deep in our nature to help those who are close to us or those who matter to us. It's not so deep in our nature to help those who are strangers. And the whole point of Christian ethics or humanist ethics, which are derived from Christian ethics, is that we have a responsibility to care for others, to care for the wider world, care for things beyond our own immediate needs and our own immediate families. So that's where you get a bigger dimension to being kind. And that comes about through a sense of relationship. Kind comes from the same root as the word kin, as in kinship, being related to others. If we feel that we humans, or just Americans, or just British, or whatever, better than everything else, the world owes us living, and all that matters is our own good, then we feel disconnected from other people and disconnected from nature. If we feel that we're related to other animals, closely related, and plants and to plants and to the earth, to this whole planet, then we feel much closer to it. It's part of our kin group, it's part of our family, as it were, and caring about it then becomes much more important.
So, first off, I think it's kind of ridiculous that we even have to have this conversation, because everything you're saying is just so obvious, and I wish everyone knew it. And second, what is the point? What's the point of all of these things you're saying? What's the point of going beyond? What's the point of finding these different ways to go beyond? And what is the point of I mean, your last chapter is called "Why Do Spiritual Practices Work," which I think is really important. And then, in addition, why should we do spiritual practices? I mean, you sort of said this at the beginning, and I just want to sort of close it off with that.
Well, because I think we have a spiritual nature. Our consciousness is not the ultimate consciousness of the universe. It's a very small fractal of the consciousness of the behind and within all things. And we're incomplete without that relationship. And if we don't form it through spiritual practices and recognize our connection with God, the all, the ultimate, whatever word you choose, if we don't find that relationship, then we miss it. We miss it, and we try to substitute for it in all sorts of ways, getting stuff which we think will satisfy this need, consumerism, addictions, obsessive behavior. We're just saner and healthier if we recognize our true nature, which is that the spiritual part of our being has a potential connection with a greater spiritual reality. And when that's in place, we feel happier, more aligned, more able to be kind to others, more related to the world around us, and we have more fun. There's everything to be said for that, and nothing to be said for living in a state of spiritual starvation, which we try to satisfy through material goods. And modern secular societies are very much in that state at the moment, which is destructive for people in those societies and destructive for the world we live in.
This reminds me of a famous line by R.D. Lang about how do you plug a void plugging a void. And he was talking about using defense mechanisms as unsuccessful means, or using consumerism as an unsuccessful mean to plug a void. You're trying to plug a void using a void. And it seems like you're talking about, why don't we actually not use a void to plug the void, but why don't we actually immerse ourselves in the larger world, in the larger universe?
Exactly. It's there all around us. And actually, the very best starting point is gratitude. That's a subject I discuss in my book, Science and Spiritual Practices. When we recognize everything we have is a gift, our life is a gift. The earth's a gift. I didn't deserve it or work to be born. I was just given my life by my parents. I was cared for them. That was a gift. They didn't have to look after me. The earth is a gift. The universe is a gift. And when we recognize that, and when we recognize that we're part of a flow, and we can give thanks for that, then I think that helps to align us with this sense of flow. So gratitude is actually something all of us can do every day, you know, a period spent every day just thinking about the things for which we're grateful, the blessings that have come into our lives, by itself makes us happier. And also, I think, puts us into a truer relationship with the world in which we live.
Well, thank you so much for all of that. And thank you so much for your work in the world. And I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been Dr. Rupert Sheldrake. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.